Hi, welcome to Holden Village. Today in the Creekside Room, the speaker is Jim Boyer. Jim will be speaking on the spirituality of the family. So let's listen in on Jim Boyer.
A little bit about myself, and then we can instruct the tape people to start. I'm a Lutheran pastor, do marriage and family therapy full-time in Portland, Oregon. Hearing where people are from, had to feel like we're just down the road compared to Minnesota or different places like that. I've been here now for 1 week. It's our second week in Portland. I have a full-time counseling ministry, trained therapist, do some teaching at Merrill Hertz College, and mainly try to keep ahead of my two children, Aaron and Emily, who are 10 and 9 years old. And those families who bring in teenagers for attitude adjustments or different things like that, I learn a lot from them and take notes of whatever we talk together. So
you'll be an expert by the time your kids get that age.
I'll at least have some ideas and maybe some things to avoid. I'm sure we'll make our own mistakes.
Yeah.
That's no question about that. So, well, let's begin then, and just to outline briefly what we'll cover today is looking at spirituality generally, and then spirituality as it relates to the family, with as many questions and discussion points as we can generate, developing together an idea of what the spirituality of the family might sort of look like and sound like, and try to get a sense of that together in a more general sense. As the week go on, I'll be doing some things around some other themes, and that'll include what I'm calling soul-friendly parenting, and that's just some parenting kinds of patterns that we might say are spiritually sensitive or friendly to the soul of both the young people and the parents. Also, divine character parenting, basically meaning reflecting divine character in our humble efforts to be adequate parents, to pick up the guidance of divine character and see what that gives to us in terms of direction in that work. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah. Then children as meaning makers will be another session later on, and that will have to do with the theory of Jerome Kagan. I forget how to pronounce his name, but we'll look at that briefly and talk about supporting children in their effort to make meaning out of the world, usually their own. Unfortunately, we try to help steer that, but they usually come up with their own answers. And then finally, parenting and spiritual wholeness, in which we'll talk about the general direction of spirituality and how parenting can be a central aspect of that, and in fact a place of fulfillment for that kind of direction in one's life. But today, as we say, we'll look at spirituality generally, and to start us off, I've just given us a working definition of that. Don't have an author or anything to give you with that, but I think if we consider spirituality as something to do with our thirsting and hungering after God, as Psalm 42 says, I hunger and thirst after you, Lord, we can have a sense that spirituality is part of being a creation and children of God. But the whole business of knowing God and our sense of being known by God is something that often is a little difficult to grasp or to define or even to share necessarily or talk about. But if we can affirm that as human beings and creator and creatures of a loving creator, that spirituality is part of our life, however formal it is or however defined or conscious, is something that all created life is about at some level. And we want to add in that God is seeking us. When we say self, we mean us or the individual person, since we see in Scripture the witness of a God who seeks out his people first, most clearly, the Old Testament, his chosen people, the Israelites, very upset when they don't respond or don't stay faithful to the covenant. But he continues to pursue, continues to seek, continues to connect in different ways, and ultimately in sending Jesus to be with us shows his connecting, reaching out love. And in our own lives, we might have a sense, and each of us could tell our own story about our sense of God being in our life and coming to us, perhaps at times of desperation or confusion or difficulty. But most of us can relate an experience of God being there, as well as very lengthy times, perhaps, when God doesn't seem to be there very close. And church, particularly a Lutheran church, that's the church I know the best, the talk about that sometimes is a bit rare. It is our personal experiences of God coming to us and our seeking God. But that's what we have to do. That's what I would offer as a working definition of spirituality. Now, as a group, I like to do stuff as a whole group, so help me out here. I'm on vacation, you're all on vacation, so let's share the work here at this point. let's develop a list, if we can, about things that just come to mind, given this working definition. What are some of the, we're going to look at two different lists. One will be aspects of spirituality, that is, things that would be involved in spirituality generally, and then also questions or activities or behaviors that go with some of those aspects. And I'll start with one so you just kind of get the idea, and then let's see what else we can come up with. See, the purple's kind of running out, so let's turn to red and see how we're doing here. Generally, in spirituality, is where we look at West spirituality or East, or where we look, there's usually some relating to sacred text, okay? So we have aspects here. Ooh, this is good. And questions. See, we always, when I'm talking about spirituality, you often hear the phrase of living the questions of spirituality, the deep existential questions of life. Who am I? Where did I come from? What's the purpose of life? That sort of stuff. And so questions are one way to understand our spirituality, that the aspects of spirituality can be related to a certain fundamental question of life, or behaviors and actions. Also, so spirituality, it's a very spiritual fly there, see? So one aspect would be, let's say, perhaps becoming familiar with sacred texts, or let's just say sacred texts. For us, of course, it's the Bible. And from early on in our families and in our churches, we get into reading and telling biblical stories. So, often in my pastoral counseling ministry, we'll talk to the young parents who were churched, fallen away from the church, or whatever word, we just kind of drifted, or you know, aren't attending church anymore. And once they have children, along about 3, 4, 5 years old, they begin to relate a concern within themselves. How will our children know the sacred text? How will they know the stories? And it's a powerful motivation for reconnecting to church and to religious life. Very common. If y'all have, or maybe have lived through children going away from the church, having children often will bring the back around. So there's one idea. That's one aspect. Sacred text. What else comes to mind? What other things that comes to your mind when you think of spirituality? Kind of a word association.
Praying.
Okay. Uh-huh. That would be on the action behavior over here. Okay. Prayer. Okay. And are there other things that come along with prayer? I think we pray and hymns, singing hymns, and that sort of thing comes to mind. We have formal prayer. We have personal prayer. All those sorts of aspects come to mind. So that would be an individual establishing an individual expression towards God,
or even a dialogue. Some people talk about prayer as a dialogue. Then if we expand that, if we just keep expanding that, then we might talk about all that we do in our spirituality to connect with God or address God, which we'd also do in worship, which would be a very typical form of another aspect of spirituality. Some form of worship that we would see in most spirituality. So, you know, prayer, singing, adoration, those forms.
Meditation in there somewhere, don't
we? Meditation? Yeah, I think that's, you know, there's I think all this would go along in here because, because there's a, you know, there's an aspect of worship that opens ourself to God. Sam Keen, in his book Hymns to an Unknown God, has said it's sort of strange that we put God on a schedule as if a blessing will come or an inspiration will come, you know, at Sunday at 11 o'clock or every evening at 7:30. But we got to schedule worship sometime. And the issue is the attitude of openness, receptivity, meditation, reflection towards God. Yeah, anything else? Another aspect for behavior. I think in terms of spirituality, what it functionally does in a person's life, what does it do for us? What do you say?
Concerted for our neighbor.
Okay, all right. So which might be an outcome?
Which has many aspects, of course.
It certainly does. Yeah. So but actions or behaviors of compassion, we might say, that has a lot of many forms. Caring for our close family, participating in peace and justice things. That movement of being loved and then loving is certainly connected to all spiritualities. There's not a spirituality that doesn't emphasize being connected or being somehow encountered by loving God and then having that come out in some way. So the aspect there may be transformation. Let's say, since I think we have to add our psychology into here, compassion, it's arguable whether that's a natural thing or not. I mean, I think for our family, you know, for those who give us love, there's a natural sense of responding. But, that's probably a debate. I think psychologists would probably debate that. But so if we say that spirituality has something to do with transformation, that is, converting and transforming us into beings who participate in love and reflect love, or are, we might say, conduits of love in our own life, then I think that would be a very universal aspect. So a question might be, am I loved? And through compassion, how do I love others? That again, spirituality orients us in that direction. Okay, any other thoughts? Compassion. Of course, I have a list here.
Just study, not sacred text. Would that be a separate one, like?
This would be good. I think to add to that, I like the sense of openness, learning, lifelong learning, that sort of thing. Sacred text is just as a way. Actually, my wife I was reading aloud some to her on some of the things we'll look at today by Thomas More, Soulmates, and something that she goes, she's just listening to that, and it's very hard to understand to start with. But she says, wow, you know, this sounds like scripture. You know, and we read things like that, things that are inspirational. Literature is inspirational. I mean, we could all name books or stories or poems or poets or authors who are deeply spiritual and inspirational. So let's add that into to texts which reveal what we would say God in the world or God messages. Sacred texts, just learning generally
or studying. It doesn't just happen when we're serious either. I mean, you'll be searching for it, but you hear about a good book, so just reading, period. Emily Dickinson said that getting a letter from a friend was one of the most spiritual things she ever did, because in getting a letter, she got the person's mind without the body. So it was like, you know, Emily Dickinson is pretty. She sees things at a little bit of an angle, but that was her description and her inspirational spiritual sense of getting the letter. It was some as a piece of somebody's soul that she was receiving, and we certainly get that in literature. Any of us who have written extensively or write know that that's very, we have to tie into something deep inside of ourselves, and that we certainly comes through in literature. Okay, let's see. What else? How about it relates to compassion, I think. If we just twist it a little bit different, say empowerment, then we could say, and it's all related, these get kind of overlapped here, but this has to do more with conversion, see, I think transformation. Empowerment would have to do with how do I respond in life, issues of vocation, and or how do I discover my response ability, my ability to respond to the situation that I find myself in. We could say, I think we could say that empowerment is another aspect of spirituality. We need inspiration, we need guidance, we need direction. So empowerment might be another one. And another one to just slice it through a little bit more would be discernment, I think. Probably not spelled right, but you get the drift. And that has to do with what is the more excellent way out of the end of 1 Corinthians 12. I'll show you a more excellent way. What is that more excellent way of all the choices? We have an incense or an instinct for that, but what is it? It's spirituality. Will help us continue to process that or search that out in any given situation. Now, all of these, I think we could say, move us towards a way of living in which we are seeing and relating to others, seeing ourselves and relating to ourselves and others through God's eyes. So there, I think we, when we see spirituality again as God seeking self, seeking the individual, seeking God, meeting us in that openness and that desire to know at deeper, deeper levels, we can, I think that moves towards seeing and relating to self and others through God's eyes. We never get there, of course. This is a lifelong thing. So, you know, even us confirmed Lutherans, we never get there. There's a lifelong process going on. Okay, now, let's add another dimension here. We're talking about spirituality of the family. So God seeking self, seeking God through family life. Or the family. That strange grouping that we call the family. I often relate to it as the cosmic lottery, the group that we find ourselves in. Did we choose? Some people think so. Shirley MacLaine, I believe, does think that that she chose her parents. Now, as you know, I mean, that's a viewpoint. Who knows? These things, these are their opinions, basically. There's no science of spirituality that I know of, anyway. But when we think about the spirituality of family, then we're lurking, I think, focusing in on how this whole business of seeking and being sought comes into the family, into the family experience. And there, I think, we can begin our search together for some of the details about that. But any questions, comments about this kind of understanding? One of the resources I'm most familiar with around this issue is a book by Morton Kelsey. Those of you who've been with me before know I carry around a sack of books here. Nordstrom shopping bags are very good, they're strong, and care about what's going on. Morton Kelsey, Companions on the Inner Way, The Art of Spiritual Guidance, is a book that probably goes in more depth than any of us really need, but we'll review the history of spirituality, the difference between Western and Eastern spirituality, and give you an excellent description of what he calls spiritual guidance, or spiritual direction, which, along with pastoral counseling, is certainly a growing field, and it has to do with basically sharing your spiritual walk with another person who has some training in listening to that, and not guiding you actively or imposing anything on you, but just being a safe place to relate what's happening in your spiritual life. And he's a very strong advocate of a conscious spiritual life, including that kind of a connection. I think that can exist in close friendships or certainly in spouse relationships too, where there's an active sharing, you know, of your spiritual walk. This is an interesting resource. I wanted to show it to you. Let me give you a couple of 75-cent words. He makes a difference, for instance, between what he calls cataphatic spirituality, which is basically Western spirituality, because that has to do with relating to God through images. Okay, and then God comes to us in a mediated way. The Lutherans are very big on means of grace. God comes to us through the Word and the Sacrament, through the sacred texts, and through baptism and the Lord's Supper. That would be a cataphatic understanding of spirituality. It would connect that way. Eastern spirituality will focus more on what he calls an apophatic spirituality. That means without images and without symbols. And that's based on the conviction that there's no way to apprehend God. There's no way to put a handle on him or box him or her up, see? And so the practices of meditation and emptying self and getting beyond ego is what Eastern spirituality focuses on. Morton Kelsey suggests that both are important. Neither one really of itself, you know, may limit the aspects of spirituality. I think an apophatic one, where we're emptying ourselves, I think helps create room and maybe more receptive kind of spirituality. The cataphatic one maybe has a little more to do with thinking and cogitating about spirituality, and so that's another important aspect also, I believe. So, if we go to spirituality of the family directly, then I think we can begin to look at how that gets worked out in the family. And let me share a story with you from one of my favorite authors, Walter Wengren, that depicts this in a story form and in his wonderful way of relating things. And again, this would be... this talks a lot about parenting, but also the rights of any child in a family and how love is communicated. It says, "Let the children laugh and be glad. Oh, my dear, they haven't long before the world assaults them. Allow them genuine laughter now. Laugh with them till tears run down your faces. Till a memory of pure delight and precious relationship is established within them, indestructible, personal, and forever. Soon enough, they'll meet faces unreasonably enraged. Soon enough, they'll be accused of things they did not do. Soon enough, they will suffer guilt at the hands of powerful people who can't accept their own guilt and who must dump it, therefore, on the weak. In that day, the children must be strengthened by self-confidence so they can resist the criticism of fools. But self-confidence begins in the experience of childhood. So give your children, your grandchildren, your nieces and nephews, the dear ones, children of your neighbors and your community, give them golden days, their own pure days in which they are so clearly and dearly beloved that they believe in love and in their own particular worth when love shall seem in short supply thereafter. Give them laughter. Observe each child with individual attention to learn what triggers the the guileless laughter in each? Is it a story, a game, certain family traditions, excursions? Elaborate fantasies, simple winks, what? Do that thing. Because the laughter that is so easy in childhood must echo its encouragement a long, long time, a lifetime. But yesterday, even in my own community, these are the things I saw. I saw a man walk toward me on the street leading two children by the hand. His mouth was as straight as the slot of a mailbox, his eyes drawn tight as ticks. He wasn't looking at me. I greeted him. He did not answer. I greeted the children by name, the boy and the girl, and although these are our neighbors, I saw an instant and marvelous duplication. The children's mouths sucked in, as straight as mailbox slots. Their eyes contracted, tiny and hard, like ticks. And I saw the cause of the change. The man, never yet glancing at me, had clamped their hands into silence. Now, there may be many reasons why my neighbor would harden his heart against me, and some of these reasons may be reasonable. And perhaps it is not unreasonable that he should harden his children as well, but while he has always carried his face like a cuttlefish, the boy had laughed quite blithely in my front yard the day before yesterday, and often the girl had made beautiful blushes and affectionate giggles when we spoke. They are changing. They are mimicking their elder. And so, a woman picked at her child, a baby no more than 2 years old. She was picking at him, pinching him, pushing him, prodding him forward as she walked, and he trotted down the center of the mall. But the woman was scarcely aware of her own behavior. She was enjoying a conversation with another woman, friends out on a shopping trip. But the baby couldn't maintain their adult pace, so she kept pushing his shoulders faster, faster, while his eyes grew huge with the fear of falling. Her eyes were fixed on her friend, without looking at the child, without ever losing the thread of her conversation. She interrupted herself to admonish him. "Dad," she said, "poke, poke, keep moving. Go," she snapped, "poke, move it, dummy, poke, poke, poke." Finally, the woman stopped and, with her hand on her hip, actually looked at the kid. "Dad, what is the matter with you anyway?" Well, he had sprawled face forward on the ground, but he had gone down in perfect silence. And to whom shall he call for safety or support? His mother was granting herself her own golden days, but at the expense of her sons. No one was laughing. I saw a well-dressed man, a professional man, a man of success and genuine repute in our community, speaking in cool and different tones to his daughter. His laughter was precise, articulate, intelligent, and devastating. No one could match his ironic contempt, least of all this adolescent. I think he thought he was being funny, that he was dealing with his daughter as an equal, two adults, straight talk, no sentiment, no wishy-washy indirection. I think he thought his manner wonderfully restrained and civil. Thus he could speak in public without embarrassment. We communicate. We don't prevaricate. We tell the truth. We can take it. Bang. But the truth he was imparting concerned her dress, her friends, her taste, and therefore herself. Bang. While his truth displayed his own self-confident intelligence and even his excellent progressive method of parenting, it shot dead the child inside his daughter. And early death. Who was laughing then? I heard inside a house two voices shouting, one belonged to an adult. "Brad, you never listen. I cook for you. I work for you. I bust my back. And all I ask for in return is a little cooperation. Do I get it? No. What do I get from you? Nothing. Nothing. Oh, no, you don't. Don't you go rolling your eyes at me, baby brother." Two voices, but the one that belonged to the child was crying. And I've heard the smack of human fury on human flesh. And I've heard the laughter that children create on their own when their elders do not care. That laughter is bitter and sarcastic. That laughter declares what their parents don't care. No, we don't care. No, nothing will get at us. And I've seen parents who, after 7 years of not caring, suddenly rise up and fight on their children's behalf against the teachers, against some judgment of the education or legal systems. These parents appear like heroes on their horizon, come to save their kids from systems which have, in fact, been trying to save the same children for the same 7 years of parental neglect. Sorrows such as these shall surely come, but surely parents, not through us. Haven't we ourselves suffered the same abuses, even as adults, and weren't they a misery more than we could stand? Isn't that motive enough to stop our tongues and stay our hands when we might wound our children? Do we need more? Then hear this, children do not exist to please us. They are not for us at all. Rather, we exist for them, to protect them now and to prepare them for the future. Who has given our children a gift to their elders? No. Not till children are grown and their elders are older indeed. Then they are the gift of the fourth commandment, honoring hoary heads which have begun to feel past honor. But until then, it is we who are given by God's parental mercy to the children, and it is we who must give to the children by lovely laughter, by laughter utterly free, and by the sheer joy from which such laughter springs, the lasting memory, you are, you are, you are my child, a marvelous work of God. Lengthy story, but relates the spirituality of parental practice, particularly how that can reflect or can inhibit seeing through God's eyes the child. And certainly, this is not making judgment on those practices. Although it says, where's the spirituality? Where is the vitality coming from connectedness with God being passed on to the children? Which touches on certainly one of the biggest challenges of family life, and that is this responsibility to be for our children or our parents or our spouses in a God-like way. But first, that starts with, of course, that connection of knowing that ourselves. And often that takes us back to an exploration of our own past, etc., which is an aspect of this spirituality that is often a painful aspect, because in order to follow or reflect God's will in our life, we get close to God's compassion for us, and knowing that is an important first step. But that's but Walter, I think, gives us a good picture of a both good and bad spirituality practice within the family, at least the results. As parents, we need to take care of ourselves, and probably one of the most frequently used interventions that I make in pastoral psychotherapy is encouraging parents to take care of themselves. Because that's often lost, or building a more healthy or vital marriage is often lost sight of, and that's certainly the foundation for good parenting practice from the beginning. Okay, any response to Walter's offering? Let's see. This is how spirituality and practice always inform each other. Now, another way to talk about this, and we talked a lot last week using the term soul, which soul and spirituality, I think, can be used somewhat synonymously. Although, let me give you some offerings from Thomas More, who gives us, this guy's really hard for me to understand, but if you were patient, I think he's fairly useful. And he talks about soul as a sort of like another member of the family, or an aspect of the family that's kind of invisible, but it relates to spirituality because it relates to that aspect of the group that is sacred, that reflects the business of joining around the fundamental biological and spiritual urge for pre-creation, for actually participating with God in creation. And I think is something that is often fairly easy to lose track of in family life, particularly because family life is so common, so everyday, and so routine. But when we focus on that, I think we're reminded of God's participation, and I think that's a good thing to be reminded of. He offers, in his description of the soul of the family, he offers this. He says, he reminds us of the Catholic prayer that goes like this. Lord Jesus Christ, who is subject to Joseph and Mary, you have consecrated domestic life with unspeakable power. Teach us by the example of your Holy Spirit, of your Holy Family, and with the help of each member, and help us live in eternal community. This prayer, Thomas More says, not only acknowledges the sacredness of family life, it also takes note of its extraordinary power. This power is not political or personal, rather it is a power of the soul. the capacity of a family to strengthen, educate, and enrich a child or another of its members goes far beyond any measurable authority or influence. By its very nature, family has an inherent power to foster human life. This power, according to the prayer, is ineffable. It cannot be spoken. It is so profound and mysterious. No psychological or sociological analysis can explain its source, but religion can attest to it. Like all powers that rise from such a deep source, it has the potential for good or evil. One family prepares a person to deal effectively with challenges throughout life, while another inflicts such deep wounds that one wonders if they can be healed. A way to articulate the deep power and spiritual energy going on in family life. Again, something we know and live with, but maybe don't often speak about. He goes on, our secular idea of family, so taken for granted in our time, easily turns inward, becoming excessively personal and ultimately xenophobic, meaning afraid of those outside the family group. It pathologizes the people who raised us rather than honoring them as having performed a sacred duty, even if it wasn't the greatest. It's honoring them for having performed a sacred duty. And by extension, it pathologizes humankind in general. If we're always looking at what our parents did wrong, that sort of a thing, then we're looking at the pathologies or the illnesses of humankind generally. If our idea of the family is narrow, limited, and secular, we may be defensive about our own attachments. And on the global scene, it will be difficult, if not impossible, to live in peace. But if we could appreciate the family as truly sacred, as a way in which life could be lived effectively and powerfully, as a way that life could be lived effectively and powerfully, then we would have a profound basis for relating on an international level. Just to say, that's our primary experience of relatedness, whether it's two-parent family, single family, extended family, whatever that unit is that registers psychologically inside of us as home or family or primary relationship. See, that it says this has ramifications for levels of community, including international community. Okay. Let's see. So he goes on about the care and things, and we won't do too much with him because, if you're enticed by this, feel free to read it. he's a little hard to grasp sometimes, but he does a good job of articulating the sacredness of close relationships of family life. Now, the main person we're going to look at in this series. See all these books I have to bring on. Is this person. His name is Ernest Boyer. This isn't him. This is the book he wrote. No relation to myself, so no connection there. The title is called Finding God at Home, Family Life as Spiritual Discipline. And this is, I'm sure there's other books like this, one of the only ones I know about. And let's look at some of his considerations. He talks about, as we talked last week, about two basic types of spirituality: life on the edge, and life in this, and or spirituality on the edge, and spirituality at the center. And I want to read you just the prayer that he uses to describe these two spiritualities. It's just a way to get a feel for these. Spirituality on the edge would this kind of spirituality might pray like this: Dear God, kindle a fire in me. Kindle it and let it burn to a white heat. Kindle a fire and let it rage inside me to feed itself on my bone and blood and sinew until I am consumed and only the fire remains. Turn my soul into a blaze, God, a blaze so bright and hot that it can be felt right through me to warm with your warmth all who come near. It's the dedication of the self for the purposes of God, which may take you wherever. It's that singular dedication to follow God's inspiration. Right? And it talks about it as spirituality on the edge, because that kind of spirituality would often take us to the edge of family life or community life, perhaps to the desert, perhaps to a mission field, perhaps into a place in which our life is endangered. When I think of this, I think of a Portlander who was killed in Central America, and Sting wrote a song about it, about him. I can't remember the title of the song. I wish I could. But this would be the kind of spirituality, deeply spiritual person down in Central America when things were much more dangerous, and I'm sure they still are in many ways. But was caught. He knew it was dangerous, but one of the many workers killed in that context. And this compares then with spirituality at the center that might pray something like this: Lord, grant that I never shun the pain of giving birth to love, nor the fatigue of the effort that nurtures it from day to day. Teach me to value each moment as I value each beat of my own heart, and to find in the pulsing of my blood that distinct tempo of birth, of growth, of love, and of death, which repeats itself over and over through a billion hearts and a million years, and which is the echo of the one eternal rhythm. Okay, so there's the daily, regular opening, being a conduit of love to the same folks, over and over again, washing the same dishes, going to the same job, paying the same bills, discussing the same issues, faithfully and in a searching way to find that way of communicating love and the closeness. And when we talk about child-parent relationships, of course, we're talking about this continued the inspiration of being that kind of. This, Ernest talks as the spirituality of the center. I'm not sure exactly why he uses that term, but that's his definition. It's family life. It's a daily relationships in which we both, and here I think it would pick up what you were saying, that compassionate aspect of spirituality, which, certainly calls for transformation in my life. I mean, having our children was certainly the most profound religious experience of my life, and yet has also been the most demanding, has revealed to me my own spiritual blind spots, weaknesses, emotional problems, all sorts of things. I think even more than being married, it probably tied. That whole business of continuing to be transformed. And as I say, I don't have teenagers yet, but I understand that as the growth occurs, you're introduced to more and more stages of transformation along the way. And then the blessing, happiness is being a grandparent, we understand, it just keeps unfolding. I often use the phrase, look what we got started, or look what you got started with, when I meet people's families and extended families. But spirituality in the center has to do with that kind of spirituality. And because it's so regular, because it's so repetitive, that's where we can, I think, lose track a little bit about the sacredness of that whole business. Good, I think, to remind ourselves. So he talks about two different spiritualities. He says, the spirituality of the desert or of the edge and the spirituality of the family are like two parts of a wheel. The first is the rim of the wheel, a life of heights and depths. It is also one that knows the grinding edge. The second is the center of the wheel, smoother, steadier, closer to that which never changes. It must also experience the frustrations of monotony and of little sense of achievement. If the second has less of the terror and uncertainty of the first, it also has less of the exhilaration. They are two very different ways of life. There may be a sense at times that excitement exists somewhere else than in family life, but if we I appreciate this structure so much because I think it gives us a way of appreciating that as individuals we certainly have both of these aspects of spirituality in us, movement towards the passion and the contribution to life and to the community that we feel inspired by God to make. And also the rootedness, and many people experience, and understandably so, the entrapment and groundedness and strapped downness of family life. As kids are very, very young, and couples or single parents or whoever caring for them become absorbed into their life and the high demands, there's a clear sense of sacrifice of self, loss of self, what Walter Wigerton calls the sacrifice, or the mother's sacrifice on the altar of motherhood, or something like that. And it's a very real thing. And then he talks about one final thing, and then let's do some more discussing. And he talks about the gifts of the spirituality of the family. And here, I think we do well to review these carefully and see what we think of these. He talks about, first of all, the gift of caring for others. Because basically he says family life has two spiritual disciplines. The sacrament of caring for others and the sacrament of the routine. Now, the sacrament of caring for others is pretty straightforward. It's that participation in God's caring and ongoing nurture in the world. The sacrament of the routine has to do with the sacredness of those everyday regular things that we do. And we'll be talking more and more about that. If we divide our time, in the family, you were going to get a pretty high percentage of the routine stuff that goes on there. And I think there's a natural tendency in our minds, psychologically anyway, to devalue the routine or the repetitive because it doesn't draw our interest so much. It isn't as stimulating or exciting. But if we nurture and develop that sense of God working through us in those activities. I think Holden, you're clearly the cooking team, the washing team. That's got to be a numbing thing. I've only done it, I'm due tonight, by the way, for washing. Did garbology today. I would not want that to become a routine in my life, for sure, but certainly the education. And yet also an aspect of worship, in another aspect of spirituality, of service, of compassion, and a very important one. To which we all, and we'll grow in our time here, in gratitude, as we had with our own caregivers, a deep and honest gratitude for that service, for the service of those simple things that are often ongoing thing in life. But there's the gift of caring for others. He calls this both a gift and a discipline. We all need, and it's a fulfilling part of our spirit to have persons to care for. He suggests that we would seek that out in one form or another. But it's also a discipline in that we certainly don't always feel like doing the care. This is where, of course, children, I think, catch us short a little bit, and that can be difficult. One concept I work in therapy a lot with is what I call the mommy or daddy dollars that an individual received in their family, and then drawing on that bank account when they have children. And it's just it's oversimplified, of course, but it's a metaphor for understanding that I think the unique challenge in having children, and that is, as Wigerton was saying, is we're the gift to the children. We are their resource in life. Where do we get that energy, that endless energy? I know I'd be taller if I didn't have two children. What is it? 2, 10, 2, 4, 6. Of course, I went through the feeding. I did sometimes. Our second birth was twins, and that was something else. But see, it's the discipline. How do we keep that energy up to do the caring for others? Certainly a gift, and it scratches an itch in our soul, but then it's also a challenge. Second gift he talks about is the gift of vulnerability of love. And here he relates to the gift of, first of all, with a spouse or a close friend or a close colleague or any workplace as close as any place we let somebody know who we are, we're being vulnerable. Okay? There's no more courtship once we get married. People know it. And then we have get other people who will know us their whole life. Until they, you know, their whole life, and we know their whole life, which is a very special and unique relationship, of course, and we have children. But it's that vulnerability. He talks about it as a gift of vulnerability, because this is the kind of relationship that that family kind of relationship offers, in which somebody knows us. Somebody can confront us on our weirdness and our eccentricities. And here's where I think spousal feedback is so helpful, as well as our children continue to teach us about our warps and warts, and continue to provide them a guide to our own growth. But it's that the vulnerability of love is that being a relationship in which we're deeply known. I often hear from, sometimes I hear from people who say, I don't want to have children, the rate of having children has dropped off quite a bit, or the average age is really stretching out there. Average age for marriage, by the way, for first marriage is 25 years old, okay? And I think for the first pregnancies is pushing 30, but as an average. So that's something that's really changing here. It wasn't that long ago, we were talking about probably, 6 or 7 years earlier. But I hear people saying, I really struggle with the decision to have children. I don't want to pass on the bad habits of my own background. I could have said that. I saw a pretty bad habit. But it's a vulnerability of love that says, how do we do something different? See, and here's where I think one of the aspects of empowerment, how do I respond, and transformation, am I loved, compassion, how do I love, is that there's that vulnerability sense. Is we're on the line now. We're on the adults. Once we have kids, once we're married, anybody has, debates on when you're grown up. there it is, when you have adult responsibilities. And therefore, then we're on the, we're on the block, so to speak. We're up front. How are we going to do it? Okay, we didn't have good examples. Okay, But we got to where we're at, and we've stepped into adult responsibilities. How then do we enact that in our own lives? That's a vulnerability of love. We're out there. Third would be center of trust that family can provide. Who loves you? Who loves you? After a day of therapy when I don't know if I did any good, and you just wonder sometimes, stuff like that. Go home. Who loves you? Hug from the kids, my wife. It feels good. It's a place, that home experience of where you're recognized, where you're supported. And in terms of children, of course, where you're given the support, but not, you belong as long as you're a certain type of person, as long as you're, a certain political party or a certain denomination, et cetera, et cetera. Or a certain profession, but it's that freedom. You belong, and hey, all right, you want to do this or that? Well, we still love you. It's the basis of trust, and. The spirituality of gifts of spirituality of family is that gift of trust when it works well. Finally, Warrior talks about the gift of the eternal and temporal coming together in the family, and which another author talks about experiencing the home beyond the home. Okay, and here's where, as a family therapist, I'm trained in what's called a systems theory. More specifically, I'm trained in transgenerational cycles, family psychotherapy, which is a big term for looking at family history in three generations. Okay, anybody comes in my office, we're going to look at their present family, or emotional network that they're living in, the family they grew up in, and the family that their caretakers grew up in. So we're going to look at that whole legacy, the whole pattern of care, nurture, abuse of different sorts, imbalances, overbalances, all sorts of dynamics on a three-generational frame. Okay, and that begins to, I talk about it as pulling the camera lens to a wide enough angle to begin to see some of the themes and some of the dynamics that may be at work in this family legacy or the family story that a given individual or couple may find themselves in. I share that because this fourth aspect, I think, has to do with, again, coming back around to a sense of spirituality that all of us belong to a home or to a father, mother, father, God, is beyond our particular family. That's my point, is that, you know, whatever deficits we've experienced or whatnot, it's not just that God fills that gap, but God, in his adoption of us and naming us, has indeed placed us into his and her own family. So that's the other gift, that there's an internal aspect to this. And let me use Boyer's words, probably explains it better, I think. He says, the fourth gift is a chance to live the greatest of all rituals, one that moves along to celebrate the intimate details of the human seasons. It is a ritual that passes the point at which life is transformed into prayer. The first three gifts of the spirituality of family, care, love, and trust, are those that come from reaching out to those nearest to you and into the world beyond. But it is at this point that the gifts are all transformed, so that you come to feel the world reaching out to you in turn, but not the world as an abstraction. Better, rather to say, that you come to sense some powerful force at the center of all that is, a force at once infinite and majesty, while also small and intimate, vaster than the universe itself and as close to you as the beating of your own heart. To come to know this is to come to know those earlier gifts of another level entirely. It is to know a care for us far beyond the care we can give to others, to know a love for us willing to become so vulnerable as to suffer death, and to know a trust for who we are, that even as that love holds us, nurtures us, it also leaves us free to become whatever we determine we must become. It is to know that no matter how avidly we might reach out to embrace the world and all it contains, there is an infinitely powerful, infinitely loving force reaching out to embrace us more avidly still. God seeking self, seeking God, business of spirituality. Okay, well, that's a lot. I'm going to keep doing some more work here. what aspects of this is new or challenging to any of your thoughts or just enriching?
I wanted to ask you, you said in your counseling, you counsel back three generations.
Yeah.
Now, that would mean, for instance, that, say, my children were coming as a young families come to you for counseling,
right,
that you would search my generation, my parents, and my grandparents? Or
no, just your parents.
That?
Yeah, just your parents. This is maybe an illustration.
Okay, I wasn't sure what you meant.
Sure, yeah. It would look like this. We do a genogram, which is very interesting to do, by the way. So we have a person. This would be the wife and the husband here, a little more square edges. Then the family they grew up in, see, let's say they were a first out of four children. And then we have over here, say they were the youngest of three. And then we look at these families also. Because what you get, often some significant patterns. For instance, I do a clergy support and consultation group, and one thing we do is we start with this particular map. And speaking of chosen vulnerability, we look at this, we talk about their background, and one question I ask them is, who ordained you in your family? That is, say this is a clergy person here, okay? The question we might ask is, who is most interested in your ordination? Who's most who's most excited about that? Who's most supportive of your being ordained? That's just one way to connect that and look at that. Maybe it was an uncle over here, or maybe a grandparent. See, so say if this was this was a client, or if this was the client relationship, then it would be, in your case, it would be.